Hey there, it's Todd Zwillick in for Joshua Johnson. A message on our podcast this week. We messed up. We made a change to our web servers that we didn't expect to have any effect on our podcasts, and clearly we were wrong, and it forced a bunch of episodes into NPR podcast feeds, resulting in downloads that you didn't ask for. It also made it hard or impossible for you to find and listen to your favorite NPR podcasts. We are truly sorry for this. We fixed the root cause of the problem shortly after we discovered it, but it's taking a while for that fix to make it into all of the podcast apps. If you unsubscribe from this show or any other NPR show, please take a minute and resubscribe. If you're still having problems, go to our website, npr.org/help. We are taking steps to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again. Thanks for listening, and now on to the show. This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. Sincerely yours, Robert Mueller. That's how the special counsel signed a letter to Attorney General William Barr at the end of March. Now it's May, and it's Barr's sincerity that's in question. Mueller's note was a revelation about the special counsel's disappointment that Barr's summary of the Russia report misled the public. The letter came to light just a day before Barr testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee and 2 days before he refused to speak in front of the House Judiciary Committee. The AG is now facing calls from Democrats for him to resign, be impeached, or be held in contempt of Congress. But what does this week's drama on the Hill mean for the president? We have so many questions. We know that you do, too. So without further ado, let's dive into the Friday News Roundup. Joining me this week is Mark Fisher. He's senior editor with The Washington Post. Mark, great to have you here.
Good to be here.
Kimberly Adams is here, correspondent for Marketplace. Kimberly, what a pleasure.
Thanks, Todd.
And Josh Gerstein is here, senior legal affairs contributor for Politico. Hey, Josh.
Nice to be with you, Todd.
Well, Josh, let me start with you. What did you take away from this week, William Barr on Capitol Hill in both the Senate and very glaringly not in the House?
Well, I was struck by the degree to which, once again, Attorney General Barr did President Trump's bidding. He went to the witness table there in the Senate, and he again portrayed the president as a man whose anger about the Mueller probe was righteous. This is a tack that Barr took in the first press conference that he had announcing the imminent release of the Mueller report. While he got into a lot of tangles with Democratic members, it was very clear that this is a lawyer who, as attorney general, is going to be advancing the president's interests. And that was really what struck me as the main takeaway, because there were people when Barr came into office who thought, okay, he's a very conservative attorney. He's clearly like a lifetime Federalist Society achiever, but we might have a very detached analysis of the law here. And I think a lot of people after these series of appearances are saying that's not exactly what we're getting.
Mark Fisher, what was the big picture for you?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to what Josh says, but it's also true that Bill Barr is someone who was chosen not for his personal loyalty to Donald Trump, but because he had a set of principles that happened to mesh with the president's needs at this point, which is Bill Barr's a strong believer in the power of the president, the power of the executive. And so he was kind of making that argument as much as it was a personal defense of Donald Trump. You watch this thing and it looks like he's doing the president's bidding. And indeed, he is the president's appointee. And attorney generals, whether they are Bobby Kennedy, the brother of the president, or others who have strong political alignment with the president, they do tend to support the president. We have this notion that the chief law enforcement officer of the country should be distanced and should, have that as the priority over the politics, but that's not the way it's generally worked in American history.
Kimberly, attorney generals do generally support the president, but they don't always go in front of Congress or in front of the press and echo the president's language, using the word collusion. I don't know how many, 30 or 40 times, using the word spying to describe FBI investigations when there was evidence that Russia was all over the Trump campaign, and they were. So there's something different here.
There is something different, and the Democrats haven't quite seemed to come up with a unified way to respond. You have some, as you mentioned, some people calling, saying we should, hold him in contempt. Then what? What happens then? There's a dubious understanding of what then would happen if, say, he refused or Trump pardoned him or something like that. And this is increasing calls for impeachment, which Speaker Pelosi has been trying to tamp down. And there's a real sense that Barr is kind of working them over in these hearings, and they don't quite know how to respond.
And I want to make sure we get to the big picture of what's in the report and how overseers and Democrats react on Capitol Hill and what's at stake. Let's go back to Wednesday, though, just to make sure we review exactly what William Barr had to say to the Senate Judiciary Committee when he gave some of the justifications for his interpretation of the Mueller report.
We prepared the letter for that purpose, to state the bottom line conclusions. We used the language from the report to state those bottom line conclusions. I analogize it to announcing after an extended trial what the verdict of the trial is, pending release of the full transcript. That's what we were trying to do, notify the people as to the bottom line conclusion. We were not trying to summarize the 410-page report.
Josh Gerstein, Democrats want to know, if that's true, why did Bob Mueller write to you, Bill Barr, and say essentially, call it a summary, call it a summation, call it whatever you want. The public is misled about what I found.
Right. And this is one of the points that ended up getting Barr in trouble. He had, in a previous appearance on Capitol Hill, been asked if he had any idea what was leading to news stories saying that members of Mueller's staff were upset with the way he portrayed the report in his initial letter to Congress about it. And he gave an answer where he said, no, he really didn't know that. He suspected or thought that maybe there were people on the staff that thought he should have put out more information. But he suggested in his response, this was in response to a question from Representative Charlie Crist of Florida, that he was a little bit mystified by the claims that had appeared in the newspaper. And now we know that he not only had was aware of the complaints from the special counsel, had gotten this very unusual letter from Robert Mueller saying he objected to the way the report had been framed. And there'd been several other communications, a personal phone call and some other contact with the special counsel's office. So Barr came under fire from Democrats for, at a minimum, misleading them, and other Democrats saying that he actually lied to the Congress.
Kimberly?
And in that clip, Barr was saying, you know, he wasn't trying to summarize it. Well, he didn't actually need to, because as Mueller laid out in the letter, he had an executive summary and documents that he did want to release to the public.
You know, I think what's happening with Bill Barr is he appears to be this sort of old school Washington figure, very tamped down, low-key demeanor, a bit ironic and all of that. And yet what I think Donald Trump values about him is that he's also a New York street fighter. They're both from the city, and they have that that sort of gutter kind of instinct. And that, so their styles are different, but I think Bill Barr is someone who is going to fight for both his principles and this president. And the Democrats are stuck here because, on the one hand, you have a public that now accepts the Mueller report, large majorities in recent polls saying that they accept the findings of the Mueller report, and they believe that Donald Trump lied, and yet at the same time, support for impeachment is declining. And the large majority now says, forget the impeachment thing, move on, talk about some issues. So the Democrats find themselves in a very difficult place here. They're sort of morally driven to go after the president, and yet, on the other hand, that's not what the public wants.
And let's hear from the person who exemplified that dilemma in the Congress this week. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was asked by a journalist whether the Attorney General had committed a crime when he did what you talked about, Josh, failed to disclose Robert Mueller's concerns over his summary when asked by lawmakers. Here's what the speaker said.
He lied to Congress. He lied to Congress. If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime. Nobody is above the law, not the President of the United States and not the Attorney General. Being the Attorney General does not give you a bath to go say whatever you want, and it is the fact because you are the Attorney General.
Now, therein lies the dilemma, Josh Gerstein, because the Speaker of the House herself has tamped down expectations of impeachment of the president, asked directly about the Attorney General, used very strong language. That is a bold charge. Lying to Congress is a crime.
Yeah, and it seems to me like there's a bit of a dance going on here with the Democrats, where you have them saying things that they want to say to satisfy their base, people who are extremely concerned about the president's conduct with respect to Russia and with respect to the 2016 election. And then, as Mark was saying, other people who are more interested in hearing about issues that could sort of frame the upcoming presidential campaign. And that tension is going back and forth. We also saw at these hearings on Capitol Hill various presidential candidates who had a moment to ask questions of Barr and use that opportunity, I think, to try to get into some kind of a heated exchange with him. There's clearly a lot of pressure among Democrats to try to be seen as the most confrontational and the person that's really sticking it to the Trump administration.
We got this comment from A, who wrote us an email. No, the AG is just following the law here. Get over it and move on. Stop seeing things that aren't there. And Kimberly, I think that reflects the attitude not only of a lot of Republicans on the Hill, but also if you watch Fox News, the president wasn't charged. No collusion, no collusion, no collusion. That's it.
It may be, at least according to the attorney general. But one of the reasons that the Democrats in Congress keep hammering in on that is some of the things that were revealed in the Mueller report about the behavior of the presidents. And there are still many, many ongoing investigations in Congress from which, you know, there are going to be more documents. I mean, they're going after some of the financial records of the Trump administration. There's all these counter lawsuits happening back and forth. And so even if this is done, which I think the writer is correct, that the Democrats really don't want to let go of this, it also is spawning all of these other things for which the Democratic Party thinks there are real legitimate, in some ways, constitutional concerns.
Mark Fisher, we're going to take a quick break. Don McGahn, the White House counsel, is also at question. He's been called by the House. Are we ever going to hear from him?
I don't know. I think he probably wants to speak, and the president has made it clear that he does not want his former White House counsel to speak to Congress. It's not clear how much control the White House has. Donald McGahn is now a private citizen. He could come forward, but the president can claim executive privilege and say that all of what he would talk about is stuff that was protected by the executive privilege. So that's going to be an interesting legal confrontation.
We got this from Catherine in Mechanicsville, Virginia, who asked, what was the motivation behind Mueller's letter? What did he think his letter would accomplish if the attorney general is supposed to have the ultimate power over the decision to prosecute a case or not? Was it sent to allay his regrets that his conclusions about obstruction were too oblique? That's one question we're going to get to after the break. And we're also going to talk about the larger issues, the confrontation between the executive and the legislative. It's 1A, the Friday News Roundup. Stay with us.
Support for NPR and the following message come from VSP Individual Vision Plans, offering coverage for a low monthly cost if you don't have vision coverage through an employer. You'll get access to the nation's largest network of independent doctors and hundreds of name brand frames. Plus, you can save more than $200 a year. VSP believes you deserve to see better for life for less. Discover for yourself at needvspcoverage.com.
Weight can be a thorny topic, but Life Kit is here to give you the facts.
The scale measures the gravitational pull of the Earth at a given moment in time. The scale doesn't measure health, happiness, success, effort, or self-worth.
Here at Life Kit, we're rethinking weight. Find it wherever you're listening or at npr.org/lifekit.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick with you. It's our weekly tradition of looking back on some of the biggest news stories from recent days, talking about how they might shape the days ahead. With me for the Friday News Roundup, Marketplace correspondent Kimberly Adams. Josh Gerstein is here, senior legal affairs contributor for Politico, and Washington Post senior editor Mark Fisher. We got this message from Ginny in LaPorte, Indiana. Our Constitution is being trampled on by this president, his administration, and the attorney general. To defy coming to Congress is frightening, and there's no respect for our rule of law by this president. That's Ginny's view. I want to play you, gang, the view from Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham, who spoke to reporters after some of the hearings this week.
Why not call for Mueller to testify?
Because I'm not going to do any more
enough already. It's over. If there's any dispute about a conversation, then he'll come. But I'm not going to retry the case. I'm not calling McCann. It is over.
Mark Fisher, the Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee, says he's done.
Well, he may be done, but neither the president nor the Democrats are done. So I'm not sure that Lindsey Graham's view on this has terribly much relevance. In fact, we're going to see this continue because it's in the interests, in the perceived interests of both the Democrats and the president to keep this going. The president loves the provocation. He loves the argument, the confrontation. And the Democrats are playing right into it because they want that too. They want to see this administration declared a rogue administration. And Donald Trump is happy to wear the mantle of being the rogue president.
Josh, go ahead. Well,
I just think the Democrats haven't thought through the psychology of Donald Trump and how much he relishes exactly what they're doing.
And, Josh, if you watch this story through the bubble of Fox News, closely allied with the White House, this story isn't about Trump and Russia at all. This story is about the deep state sending pro-Hillary spies to spy on the Trump campaign. It's a completely different story, and they're running it.
Right, and we did have further disclosures about that this week, that it appears that there may have been as many as two people sent by the FBI to try to reach out to George Papadopoulos when he was a foreign policy advisor, rather young foreign policy advisor for the Trump campaign, but an advisor nonetheless, as part of what appears to have been an FBI effort to figure out whether there was something going on with the Russians and Hillary's emails and the Trump campaign. And I do have to say, I don't think the Republicans' concerns on this and the White House's concerns are completely unwarranted. To send undercover operatives, or at least one undercover operative, at a U.S. presidential campaign to try to gather information in the midst, at the very height of the campaign, right around the time of the political conventions in 2016, is an extraordinary thing, perhaps something that's never happened before in American history.
It's a big decision, and it's a tough decision to decide to do that because there are political implications, interference implications all over that. On the other hand, I am not a lawyer, but I look at this very question. If you have reason to believe, good reason to believe, that an adversary, the Russians, are all over this campaign, and our intelligence community and the Mueller report have both concluded, yes, they were, was the alternative of doing nothing a responsible option?
Not necessarily, but I think it is important for us to know at what level in the government was that decision made? What facts did people have in front of them at the time they made the decision? Were those facts accurate? You know, we have these issues regarding the Steele dossier now that's been shown to be at least partially inaccurate in several material respects, and it appears that that played into some factor in this operation that the FBI conducted. It's not clear if that involved this outreach that was made to Papadopoulos or just some of the electronic surveillance that was done. And there is a review underway at the Justice Department by the Inspector General, who's sort of the internal, sort of semi-independent watchdog in the Justice Department, as to how this whole investigation got started. Were things handled properly? Were they cleared at the right levels? And just the kind of judgments that you're talking about, Todd. And I'm not saying that one answer is right or one answer is wrong, but it does seem a worthy subject to at least explore how something like that would happen, because you could see how that kind of power could be abused against members of another opposition political party quite easily in the future.
Kimberly, you alluded to all the other investigations going on by oversight committees and various committees on Capitol Hill. And the strategy from this White House now is complete and utter stonewall, right? Former White House officials, no, you shouldn't testify. That's privileged. You will not see my tax returns. I will try to block you from talking to Deutsche Bank. I will prevent any White House personnel from answering subpoenas. Basically a blanket no. Where does this go between an executive and a Congress when they're not even fighting over individual subpoenas? It's just no.
Well, I think we should first look at where it comes from, which is Trump as a real estate businessman. You know, he ran on this, and this was his strategy in New York. You don't like something, you sue, you stall, do whatever you can, and just eventually wear people down. And unlike in the business world, he's got a set time. He just has to wear the Democrats down until. He just has to stall them until the 2020 election. And as we've heard, there is plenty of narrative to support his case to his supporters all the way up into them. They tried to infiltrate my campaign, and they did this, and they did this. this. As much as the Democrats think they can take what came out of the Mueller report and what's coming out of these investigations to wear down the president over time, 2020 is a that election is a ways away, and people are already tiring of it. Now, to the constitutional question of what it means for the executive to just ignore the demands of Congress, I mean, what you're hearing from the Democrats in the House is that he's trying to make Congress an unequal branch of government. And I think what this is revealing is that we don't necessarily have the tools to counteract this right now.
Mark Fisher, one listener asks about Don McGahn or others. What if they decide to testify over the president's objections? Don McGahn is the former White House counsel. Can he be stopped from going on the Hill? What if he decides to do it?
Well, the White House can tell him you may not speak about matters that were between you and the president. We're asserting executive privilege. I would imagine, not a lawyer, but I would imagine that Don McGahn could go to Congress and say whatever he wants to say. But could he be held in contempt if he doesn't testify? Yes. Could the White House take action against him if he does? That's not as clear. They can certainly try to instruct him. And he has no history of being a rogue White House counsel. So it's hard to see where that ends.
I feel like maybe we have the next document we want to look at is Don McGahn's non-disclosure agreement, and if he signed one with the president directly.
And do those have any real power?
Right.
Because Donald Trump has always forced everyone around him to have those NDAs.
Well, before we let this go and move on to other news of the week, I want to step back from the back and forth just for one second, because Democrats have a political choice to make. Josh, you referred to it about impeachment of the president or the attorney general, but what's at stake if they essentially legally do nothing? I mean, the Mueller report does not recommend the president be charged with a crime, but it details several instances where the president endeavored to obstruct an investigation. What message will President Trump take if there's no accountability?
Well, I mean, I do think that there are a lot of tools that Congress has at its disposal here, actually, to fight back against the president. The question is, do they want to do that? Do they want to escalate? And right now, all we're seeing, while there is this sort of squabbling in court about various issues and getting access to information, and I spend a lot of my time covering that stuff, I have to say that's a rather milquetoast response to what the president is alleged to have done here. To go to court and say we're going to ask a judge to order that you turn some information over is relatively mild. There are other things Congress can do. Congress can throw the attorney general in jail and lock him up in the basement of the Capitol. Congress can shut down the government. Congress can try to impeach, as you're saying, Todd, can try to impeach the attorney general. And yet there seems to be some reluctance among Democrats. They seem very happy to talk about all these things, but not necessarily to actually take concrete steps in that direction, probably for the reasons Mark is saying, that they fear there might be some backlash, particularly from moderate voters looking ahead to the 2020 campaign, that might be seen as overdoing it and too much of a distraction from other major challenges the country's facing.
Well, we saw some of that psychology play out before our very eyes, because one thing Democrats did do in reaction this week was go down to the White House and have very productive, apparently, and friendly negotiations with the president of the United States over an infrastructure bill. $2 trillion worth, the Democrats said. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer said they were willing to negotiate with the president over a giant infrastructure spending package. Here's the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer.
It was a very constructive meeting. It's clear that both the White House and all of us want to get something done on infrastructure in a big and bold way. And there was goodwill in this meeting, and that was different than some of the other meetings that we've had, which is a very good thing.
Mark Fisher, cognitive dissonance is what I was feeling. A Congress going at the president for being lawless, obstructing justice, blocking subpoenas, blocking not showing his tax returns, turning around and negotiating in good faith, apparently, with the president over $2 trillion that he wants.
Well, this started out as this sort of ray of sunshine and a rare bit of actual bipartisanship from the deep, dark past. And if you look at the polling numbers, 76% of Democrats, 73% of Republicans, 70% of independents all want this to be an important priority, that infrastructure spending. And then the president agrees to have a session with the Democrats where there are no cameras. He's not going to pull any tricks on them. He was quiet afterwards. It just seemed like a new dawn. And then within hours after they come out all sunshiny. Nancy Pelosi is comparing the president to Richard Nixon. Donald Trump is tweeting that the Democrats are guilty of treason, and we're back to the same old, same old. And so this sort of hurling of nasty one-liners reminds us that this infrastructure thing is going nowhere. It's going nowhere for two reasons. Number one, the politics that I just described, and number two, money, because they don't remotely agree about how to raise the money, that $2 trillion.
Well, Saul posted this on our Facebook page. Details, details, where is the money going to come from, Mark Fisher? How much will actually appear? When? What will be required? When will the repairs be done? Which ones will be done first? Agreement in principle is one thing. The details, Kimberly Adams, are the devil.
The details are the death in this case, because already the Republicans have basically put a wash on this, saying, you know, we are not going to come up with any, we're not going to allow this to be funded by more deficit financing. And at the same time, the Democrats want to roll back the tax cuts to help pay for an infrastructure bill, which, again, the Republicans say isn't going to happen. And if you think about $2 trillion over 10 years, let's say, you're talking about like, what, $200 billion a year, and it's a lot of money. And even if you raise the gas tax the way that some people are talking about, that only could go for, say, highways and bridges. What are you going to do about the water infrastructure that needs to be repaired? Trump in the past has expressed support for public-private partnerships. He's moved away from that. Even the people who do like public-private partnerships, which is allowing private companies to work with local and federal governments to fund these infrastructure projects, admit that those tend to only fund the profitable things, like a toll road. Nobody's going to do a public-private partnership to build a new sewer system in a rural area.
I want to take a pause and talk about another story that's important and kind of gets us very much out of the back and forth in Washington. There was a report from the Anti-Defamation League released this week that says that anti-Semitism has reached near historic levels in 2018. The ADL tracks anti-Semitic incidents. It found that physical assaults against Jews more than doubled last year, and that includes the murder of 11 Jews at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last year. There was another tragic scene, of course, this week at a synagogue. This past Saturday, a gunman opened fire at Shabbat services at Chabad Poway Synagogue outside of San Diego in California. The rabbi there, Rabbi Yisrael Goldstein, described the scene to CNN.
Most of my congregation was alive, with the exception, Lori Kay is laying there on the floor. Her husband, Dr. Howe, is trying to resuscitate her. He passes out and faints. Their daughter, Hannah, comes out leaning over her parents on the floor. A sight out of the pogrom days, a sight out of the Holocaust Kristallnacht days. This doesn't belong in Poway, California. This does not belong in the United States of America. We have the constitutional rights to be free people, to practice religion in freedom. We came here running from the darkness of the Holocaust to a safe haven to be free people. And now we're being gunned down in our house of worship.
Josh Gerstein, what more can you tell us about this incident?
Well, you know, this is yet another incident that we've seen in the last couple of years of extremist hate-driven violence. And there remains some significant debate, I think, about the role that the Trump administration and feelings that seem to have been unleashed by President Trump's campaign and election has played in these episodes. I do think there are many factors that are at work. Some of it has to do with the internet and social media and the ability of people to access what were previously very, very marginal opinions. I remember when I came to Washington in the early 1990s, there were, of course, people around that had anti-Semitic views. There were treatises and tracts, but mostly these were being handed out like at a subway entrance. And people's ability to distribute that kind of information was really quite limited and kind of mechanical. And now we're in an era where we see this stuff really flourish in social media. You had Facebook, for example, this week take down a bunch of what they considered extremist anti-right sites. So I think that's another factor here. And then the availability of weapons seems to be a factor as well. You have a situation where it seems quite easy for someone to go in and where you might have seen in the past some kind of a violent incident with a handgun or a stabbing or something like that. Someone can go in with an automatic weapon and just cause a complete massacre.
Kimberly, we're going to talk about another mass shooting that happened this week at UNC Charlotte in just a few minutes. But But this is gun violence of a different kind, as Josh was describing, spurred on by online white nationalist radicalization.
Right, which is a group that the Trump administration has faced a great deal of criticism for not even allowing the, you know, government agencies to look into white nationalism in the same way that they look into other types of terrorist groups or other types of groups that may do violence in the United States. And, you know, it's the rabbi's words were just so incredibly tragic. And this is one of the reasons that the tech industry is facing a lot more scrutiny from Congress and regulators now to try to control this kind of speech online.
We're going to take a quick break in just a moment. When we get back, we'll get reactions in Minnesota to the controversial conviction of a former police officer there. And we say goodbye to a Hollywood director who made a big impact in his short time behind the camera. Meanwhile, the Billboard Music Awards were this week. Drake took home the top artist honor. Taylor Swift opened the show with her new song, Me, in a glittery outfit accompanied by onstage marching bands, and it reminded a lot of people, maybe too many people, of Beyoncé's now legendary Coachella performance. And now, not surprisingly, the Swifties and the Beehive are at war on social media. More on the roundup in just a moment. Stay close. I'm Todd Zwillick.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Did you just make that up?
Well, yeah. I
just... Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
Welcome back to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's get to a few more stories with the time we have left on this Friday news roundup. I want to turn now to our 1A Across America partner, Minnesota Public Radio, because on Tuesday, a jury convicted former Minneapolis police officer Mohammed Noor of third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter for shooting a civilian who called 911. This case has drawn international attention because Noor, the cop, was black. The person he's convicted of killing, Justine Ruschick, was a white woman from Australia. John Collins of Minnesota Public Radio has been following the trial, joins us now to explain the gravity of this conviction. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a brief recap of the circumstances surrounding this shooting? Who is Mohammed Noor and why did he end up shooting the woman who called the police?
Sure. Justine Ruschick is the woman who called the police. She was 40 years old, originally from Australia, and she lived in a pretty safe, affluent part of Minneapolis. And on the night of July 15, 2017, she heard a sound in the alley. She says it sounded, or she said to dispatch, that sounded like a woman being assaulted. So she called 911. Now, Mohammed Noor was a Minneapolis police officer, and he and his partner responded to Justine Ruschick's 911 call, and he was a passenger in that squad car. Noor testified that they drove down the alley, he and his partner, their lights off, they listened, didn't hear anything, stopped at the end of the alley, and they were about to leave when Justine Ruschick approached the squad car. Now, there's a little bit of controversy about exactly what happened here, but Noor testified that there was a thump on the squad. He said his partner shouted, "Oh, Jesus," tried to pull his gun out. Noor testified that he saw fear in his partner's eyes, looked out the window, saw blonde hair and a pink t-shirt, assessed it as a threat, and fired once out the driver's side window from the passenger seat. He hit Ruschick in her lower abdomen, and she died at the scene.
How big of a surprise to the community and the people watching this trial was this verdict?
Well, you never know what a jury is going to do, but there had never been an officer convicted before in Minnesota for taking someone's life while on the job. So it was unprecedented. But one other officer previously had been acquitted on manslaughter charges. But in this case, prosecutors really aggressively tried the case. They bulked up the investigation. So by the end of the trial, it looked like a guilty verdict on at least one of the charges was a possibility.
So what's been the reaction from various communities who have a real stake in this trial?
Right. For a lot of the activists who have pushed for this sort of police accountability for years, it's kind of bittersweet. On one hand, they say they want police officers to be held accountable for taking someone's life, and they want Justine Ruschick and her family to get justice. And on the other hand, they say the racial makeup of the cop and the victim in this case, and how aggressively it was prosecuted, is one more sign that the criminal justice system has inequitable treatment for people of color.
Well, here's Nakeem Alivi, a civil rights attorney and activist there in Minnesota.
Former Officer Noor was not humanized in the same way that we've seen other officers humanized. Justine Damon wasn't demonized in the same way that we see Black victims demonized when they've been shot and killed by police. And so this whole thing stinks to high heaven.
John, sentencing is still to come in this case. What do you expect next?
Well, sentencing's happening next month, and Noor is facing about a 12-year possible sentence, according to the guidelines. In the meantime, I expect that there's going to be a lot of focus on what went wrong here, both in the shooting and the investigation that followed, because the testimony in this trial exposed really deep problems in the Minneapolis Police Department and its response, and in the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which did the investigation. So problems in how they investigated and how they conducted themselves during this. So Governor Tim Walz, Minnesota governor, has already said that he's going to push for a deep look into what happened with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And I expect that other people are going to make some calls for real substantial changes to how these agencies deal with, investigate, and prosecute fatal police shootings in the state.
John Collins is class and criminal justice reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. He's also co-creator of the award-winning podcast 74 Seconds about a white officer shooting and killing Philando Castile. John, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Well, folks here around the table with me, let's turn to North Carolina and the students at UNC, because there was another shooting that we should talk about at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Join the growing ranks, students there, of Americans who've been involved in mass shootings. A gunman opened fire on the campus Tuesday night. He killed two people and wounded four others. The heroics of one of the victims stood out. 21-year-old Riley Howell tackled a gunman and lost his life in the process. The chief of Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department, Kerr Putney, says Howell's sacrifice undoubtedly saved lives. Howell's girlfriend says he's a hero. The 22-year-old gunman waived his right to appear in court on Thursday afternoon, and law enforcement officers there still have not identified a motive for the shooting. I want to move us now on to the NRA, the National Rifle Association, who had a big confrontation and a shakeup within the last week. The NRA board voted unanimously this week to reelect Wayne LaPierre as chief executive. It also ousted former president Oliver North. This all comes after a bitter internal feud. We covered it on the show this week between LaPierre and Ollie North that played out in front of everybody at the organization's annual convention. Mark Fisher, does any of this suggest that the NRA's power is actually vulnerable? We're so used to thinking them as a juggernaut.
Well, internally, they're in disarray. They have financial problems. They have leadership problems that came to the fore this week. And so as you look at it as an institution, they've got some real troubles. And they're stuck arguing about what their basic message should be, all of that. That said, the NRA is not subject to the vicissitudes of rising and falling membership the way other large organizations like the AARP or the AAA might be. The NRA feeds on controversy, feeds on, much like President Trump, on rallying their base to this core sense of the rest of society being against them. Belonging to the NRA is not so much about owning a gun or sportsmanship. It's really about being part of a subculture of America. And so the NRA, even if it were to completely collapse, would still have that following. And that is absolutely crucial to their identity. They are a club where the internal politics of the place almost hardly matter.
Josh Gerstein, do you agree with Mark Fisher that if you're at the NRA, there's really no such thing as bad publicity?
I tend to agree that the NRA, when people think of it as incredibly powerful because of the amount of money that it has or the money that it donates or arranges to be donated to candidates, people are kind of missing the point. I mean, it's succeeded as a grassroots movement that has managed to convince its members and to play off its members' fears and concerns about efforts to ban guns and the notion that different politicians were going to take steps to rein in Second Amendment rights. And that's really what has been their rallying cry, I think what we've seen over the past few weeks is really a byproduct of an organization that has been able to flourish financially off of that movement. And I think their budget is somewhere between $300 and $350 million a year. And so if you look at it that way, it's perhaps not surprising that there would at least be allegations from some people that someone is trying to siphon off some of that money in one direction or another. Maybe the surprising thing is that we haven't heard about this before, and that the organization has managed to keep those kinds of internal frictions and rifts sort of under the carpet up to this point.
Still, Kimberly, this is an organization who, it was reported, poured $55 million into 2016, $30 million to President Trump himself. We're told over and over that fundraising is way down, membership is way down. I got two guys on either side of you who say, in some ways, it might not matter, even when you look at the numbers, because the NRA is so entrenched in American political culture.
Maybe so, but there have been, especially in the last couple of weeks as all this has played out, a lot of members stepping in and saying, you know what, the NRA has moved too far away from its core goal. Like, we're supposed to be protecting the Second Amendment, not getting into all of these cultural, religious things. And because of a lot of that sort of other political activity beyond the sort of core goal, you have New York, I believe one of the districts in New York is investigating the NRA's nonprofit status. And that's a real threat, because we saw what happened to the Trump organization's nonprofit when they were investigated. It ended up having to be dissolved. And so these money issues are going to start to matter to the people in the organization as they look to move forward.
Well, Kimberly, I'm so glad you're here, because I want to talk about the Fed.
Yay.
Before we go. And you're just the person
we
to talk to.
We love the Fed at Marketplace.
Well, you love the Fed, and America loved, I guess, a story about commentator and author Stephen Moore, who was loudly floated by this White House for an open seat on the Federal Reserve Board. His candidacy ran into some trouble. And then yesterday, just a few minutes after Stephen Moore said his nomination was a go and the White House was behind him, all of a sudden, no, they weren't. President Trump pulled the plug. Tell me about Stephen Moore and this episode by tweet, of course.
What stands out to me the most, so this is the second candidate in recent weeks that the Trump administration floated and then withdrew. Herman Cain was dealt a similar fate. What's interesting about Stephen Moore is that he has a much longer and stronger record than Herman Cain of speaking about economic policy. Much of it is incorrect, but nevertheless, he was a candidate that was floated very strongly by President Trump. And even though many, many economists, and I talked to a lot of economists, and many even Republicans were very concerned about his economic record, it wasn't that actually knocked him down. It was those comments about women.
And Kimberly, what about just the way that Stephen Moore was cast overboard? He apparently was confident that it was all good, and until it wasn't.
Well, it's hard in this environment to determine what's actually going to matter. We have a president of the United States on record with some really troublesome comments about women, to put it mildly. And so there would be reason for Stephen Moore to, his argument was that, oh, these were jokes, they were in poor taste, I apologize. It's easy to understand why he might have thought that would not be what brought him down. But over time, more and more members of the Senate said, look, we have a problem with his economic policies. We have a problem with what he's had to say about women. He's made racist jokes in the past as well that are now coming to light. We just don't want to do this.
And this is not an ambassadorship to a relatively small country somewhere. This is the Fed, and it's absolutely no joke. And I think a lot of senators got that sense as well. Well, before we go, we have one more bit of news that we want to make sure we cover. No one would dare put director John Singleton in a box. Sure, he made his name telling stories that reflected the black experience in America, like his debut film in 1991, Boys in the Hood.
Let's go.
All right, wait a minute, man. Let's split up.
No, man, I don't think we should do that. I mean, if we gotta throw some heads, I think it'd be better if we're together.
Aw, man, them fools ain't gonna wanna do nothing, man. They're just showing up.
Okay, I'll make you try. Cool. I'm out of here.
That movie earned John Singleton the distinction of being the youngest person ever nominated for Best Director at the Academy Awards. He was 23 years old. In a way, Boys in the Hood was like reading a diary entry of the director's life. Singleton was born and raised in Los Angeles. His parents shared custody, toggling Singleton between Pasadena and Inglewood, a community he displayed a deep love for on camera, even as he contended with the violent elements that put his neighbors in the crosshairs. The final tragedy we see in Boys in the Hood speaks to that love and that conflict, and you can feel Singleton imagining what might have happened had his fate met with a bullet before his potential was realized.
Ricky!
John Singleton thrived making films with majority black casts and centering black life, but no two movies in his catalog are alike. He followed Boys in the Hood with a romance called Poetic Justice, starring Janet Jackson and Tupac. Then there's the historical drama Rosewood, a remake of the blaxploitation classic Shaft, even an installment of one of the most popular film franchises of all time, Too Fast, Too Furious.
Why don't I just find y'all a fourth and we settle this on the streets, huh?
Bring him on.
Anybody I want.
Rilo.
No matter who it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. You want to race tonight?
Yeah, you know I could use the money.
You got 4 minutes, man.
All right, I'll be there.
John Singleton took chances on actors by giving well-known names opportunities to star in meaty roles, from Tyra Banks to Busta Rhymes to Ice Cube, who starred in both Boys in the Hood and Higher Learning, an exploration of how racial and social politics play out in American college campuses.
You need to think about becoming mentally competitive. Being black does not free you from being a responsible individual.
Yeah, but being a responsible individual don't free you from being black.
Now do it.
That's right.
Poor misguided soul. You have yet to learn the rules of this game.
He will. I don't want to. See, I'm smart enough to know it's not my game to play. Just a pawn like everybody else.
Used intelligently, a pawn can create a checkmate, Mr. Williams, or become a very powerful player himself.
John Singleton died this week following a stroke that left him in intensive care. He was 51. As we head into the weekend, we remember his work and its impact on storytelling and casting in Hollywood. Let's listen to a song off the soundtrack for Boys in the Hood. This is Black on Black Crime by Stanley Clarke. I want to thank all my guests for being around the table today. Kimberly Adams is a correspondent for Marketplace. Great to have you, Kimberly.
Thanks, Todd.
Mark Fisher is senior editor at the Washington Post. Mark, thank you.
Good to be here, Todd.
Josh Gerstein, senior legal affairs contributor for Politico. Josh, have a great weekend.
Thanks a lot, Todd. Enjoyed it.
Thanks to y'all for being here. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. We'll turn to international news on the Friday News Roundup right after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, in for Joshua Johnson. It's the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. In an attempt to overthrow Venezuela's President Maduro this week, plotters have seen their attempted coup fizzle. In France, President Macron grapples with how to address the demands of angry yellow vesters. Japan's chrysanthemum throne has a new emperor, and some big footprints are spotted in Nepal, renewing speculation about the existence of Bigfoot. Here with me to talk about some of the week's most interesting stories from all around the world, Nina Maria Potts. She's director of global news coverage at Feature Story News. Good to see you again, Nina.
Good to be here.
Greg Myrie is national security correspondent for NPR. Greg, great to have you here.
Hey, good to be here.
And Amna Nawaz is national correspondent and substitute anchor for PBS NewsHour. Welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start, gang, in Venezuela, because according to Tim Padgett, America's editor for WLRN, Juan Guaido is now 0 for 3 in attempts to incite regime change, a coup in Venezuela. Clashes between pro-government and opposition supporters in Venezuela this week left at least 4 people dead, hundreds of people injured. Opposition leader Juan Guaido has asked Venezuelans to protest every day until Nicolas Maduro leaves the government. Guaido told Fox Business Network, quote, "As long as we are mobilized and united, we are very close to achieving our freedom. Can't tell you a specific date or time. Working on transition. Democracy has always taken time." Greg Myrie, how serious is this latest challenge to Maduro's rule?
It's serious. We've seen this drag on for months. I'm not going to make any predictions, but it could go any number of ways. And while journalists and many observers are looking for some sort of quick change or resolution to this, it hasn't gotten very violent, and it certainly could. So, I mean, a quick, dramatic change in a country that's still very divided, where Maduro still has the military on his side, could mean a lot of bloodshed. And so far, we've seen clashes, but not large-scale bloodshed. So I think hoping for something to happen quickly isn't necessarily mean a nice, peaceful resolution. It could mean something more ominous.
Nina Maria Potts, what's Nicolas Maduro's status at this point? I mean, we mentioned 0 for 3. This is an ongoing grinding struggle. Even when there aren't coup attempts in Venezuela, there are people in the streets sometimes rioting for food, for the basics, for medical care.
Well, it's a very good question. I think we're still trying to unravel what went wrong for Guaido this week. In terms of Maduro's status, there was a lot of speculation that he was on the tarmac, ready to leave when Guaido appeared with this handful of military officials on Tuesday. It was deemed very suspicious that he didn't make a televised address or even phone in to address the nation, and he didn't appear until very late at night. And the suggestion is that he had been just about to exit before Russian intervention. I mean, I think one of the big challenges for the Trump administration right now, as it weighs up how far it's prepared to go, is what it does next and whether it consults the Lima Group and whether it gets Latin American support on board. There is speculation that Guaido himself is trying to get himself arrested to provoke a U.S. military intervention. And there is also speculation about the role of Lopez, who has claimed that he's been in negotiation for some time with military officials, but his appearance by surprise alongside Guaido, who he mentored, I think there's a suggestion that people inside the Maduro regime that had been trying to strike a deal with Guaido for a couple of months now were alarmed by Lopez's appearance because he's considered a hothead and unpredictable.
And Amna Nawaz, the Venezuelan High Court has ordered the arrest of Leopoldo Lopez. And in these situations, we tend to watch for who is close to the leadership of either side who falls away and breaks over to the other side, whether it's an important military general who abandons the government or a leader of the opposition who decides to bow out. These are the things we watch for.
That's right. And I think that's one of the things, obviously, U.S. officials are watching for as well. One of the conversations we've been having since those protests started in the streets was, how bad was the U.S. miscalculation? Did we not know, intelligence-wise, that Guaido did not have as much military support at the top brass level that would obviously make this 0 for 3 now? And I think the big question moving forward, we don't want to speculate about what happens next, is what the U.S. is prepared to do. You saw Secretary Pompeo go out as soon as the protests began and said, look, the U.S. stands prepared to do whatever is necessary. But the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has basically said, we're really hesitant about getting involved militarily here.
And I want to talk about the White House response, the American response in a country that has good reason to be extremely suspicious anytime America's eyes are on their country because of their history. But you all mentioned the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. Let's give the Secretary his turn here.
We've watched throughout the day. It's been a long time since anyone has seen Maduro. He had an airplane on the tarmac. He was ready to leave this morning, as we understand it, and the Russians indicated he should stay. We think the situation remains incredibly fluid. We know that there were senior leaders inside the Maduro government that were prepared to leave. They told us as much over the past few weeks, and we're convinced that the Venezuelan people are going to get their democracy back.
Greg Myrie, the Secretary of State, says Nicolas Maduro was on the tarmac ready to leave, and the Russians said, no, you should stay. What do we know about that? Is that a true claim? Did that happen?
I don't know that to be true. I'm not sure where it is. I think the way I would read this, a lot of signaling going on. The U.S. is trying to put as much pressure on Maduro as possible, scare him into thinking that things are about to fall apart. He should get on a plane and get out of there, perhaps encourage people to come out and protest. So I think the U.S. is signaling the same way the sides are in Venezuela. I don't know what the U.S. is planning to do, but I think this president and the U.S. military both have a lot of hesitation about getting involved militarily and owning this. I think you need to really see this as a lot of messaging that all sides are trying to nudge their supporters and their people to get the outcome they want.
And the effectiveness of that tough rhetoric comes into stark relief when the military itself or national security advisors are reluctant to put any steel behind the words. But Nina Maria Potts, I want to ask about the U.S. strategy here. Like I just mentioned, Venezuelans are extremely suspicious of the United States government, almost in any form it comes in. This coup is grassroots. It's homegrown, attempted coup, I should say, uprising against the government. There is reason to believe that there's legitimate popular opposition to a government we don't like. But a lot of people sit here in Washington and say, administration, keep quiet. If you come out strongly and loudly for Juan Guaido, it's going to turn people off in Venezuela because, frankly, they don't want to hear that the United States is on their side.
Well, a couple of things on that point. I mean, I think in referencing military officials high up and top brass, we shouldn't also forget the fact that there are armed civilians, pro-Maduro armed civilians roaming the streets of Caracas at night, trying to keep the population and the public under control, who are being paid for by the military and the government. And in terms of grassroots, I think it's an extraordinary assumption to imagine that Guaido enjoys widespread popular support. I think that there are plenty of families in rural areas and the working population of Caracas that still support Maduro and are deeply suspicious of the U.S., as you referenced. I mean, I think the other key point about the U.S. strategy in Venezuela is that President Trump has obviously made Venezuela a top priority. He claimed credit for mobilizing the international community, 50 countries getting in behind Guaido. And the stakes are quite high. I think what this week has shown is that regime change is just simply not straightforward.
Ben on Facebook writes to us, Venezuela's crisis is the result of petrostate, corruption, and ineptitude, not simply socialism. Amna Nawaz, this is a situation that's much more complicated than the rhetoric would indicate.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a confluence of factors that got Venezuela to where it was before this became the conflict it is today. And it's also worth pointing out, just to touch on another part of the U.S. response, is they have now clearly drawn a red line. It is no longer Maduro needs to step down. It's Maduro needs to go. He needs to get on a plane and he needs to get out. Secretary Pompeo was very clear about that. There's also some reporting out there that if they can't support him militarily or choose not to for a number of reasons, maybe they can do so financially in some way. So the U.S. is not out of this by any means. And at the same time, we should remind people the crisis that's on the ground right now affecting all those people, that exodus of 1.2 million folks, the aid backed up at the border, that's getting worse the longer this drags on.
But as the U.S. military hesitates to do anything militarily in Venezuela, Greg Myrie, we hear news about Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, his private army. He was a character in the Mueller report. He is the brother of Betsy DeVos, the education secretary. And now there's some reporting that he's been working, advocating to sending his own private army in to help overthrow Maduro. What do we know?
He, as you say, he keeps popping up. I think I don't know who would be supporting that. It's hard to imagine the U.S. government would again want their fingerprints on something like this. Guaido has certainly talked about a peaceful protest. It's not clear who would be supporting him, and is this just sort of Eric Prince leaking his own name as he has in other situations, talking about in Iraq or Afghanistan, offering to send in private contractors. So I am very skeptical of these reports. It's hard to imagine who would be in favor of this besides perhaps Eric Prince.
Well, Nina Maria Potts, do we have any reason to believe that the White House or the president himself would be receptive to a pitch by Eric Prince for a private mercenary army to take care of things in Venezuela?
I agree with Greg. It's incredibly difficult to read the signals. I want to get back very briefly to the humanitarian crisis. You know, our team on the ground is getting running water still for 15 minutes a day, and that's a stark reminder. And these are our journalists who are pretty well paid by Venezuelan standards.
And it is incredibly real in Venezuela, and there is a massive humanitarian challenge there as well. Gang, let's go to Iraq, or at least I think we're going to Iraq. It's really unclear where this next story has actually come from. After staying quiet for 5 years, often reported dead, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, appeared this week on a 17-minute video. We're going to spare you the full version here, but here's a brief sampling. Baghdadi appears bearded, looking relatively well. He makes a range of excuses for the loss of certain battles and lists some of those who died in the fight for the caliphate. The New York Times translated part of that video that I just played for you. He says, quote, "Our battle today is a battle of attrition, and we will prolong it for the enemy, and that they might know that our jihad will continue until the judgment day," end quote. Amna Nawaz, what did you take away from this video?
Well, one thing, he confirms that the territorial control that they once had has been gone. So, you know, White House is right about that. Administration is right about that. Territorially, we have been winning that battle. At the same time, you don't come out after 5 years of silence unless you think it is worth the risk. Because obviously, a leader of that stature, you're putting forward a lot of clues about where you might be. It's obviously intelligence teams working to unpack forensically whatever they can, whatever clues they can pull from that video. But that was a message that was delivered very deliberately, clearly not ad-libbed. There was some very specific messaging about the power and control that they still exercise, which is not necessarily on the ground in Iraq and Syria, but it is online. There was a reason that he name-checked the people that he did. There was a reason that he name-checked the countries that he did. And it was basically a call to arms to say, we still pose a very real international threat.
President Trump and his government have, of course, declared in the past that ISIS has been defeated. It seems like al-Baghdadi with this video is trying to show the world something very, very different.
Well, look, one of the men that he named, one of the French brothers, was believed to be linked to the Paris attacks and believed to be killed in a U.S. airstrike in Syria a while ago. The countries that he named are places where they've all had links to ISIS, at the very least. This is the challenge now for intelligence services across the world. And this is something that we don't have a handle on, is how to battle these ideas online, where they are proven to be even more dangerous to some degree, because it's not a military fight. It's not a fight-win-hold situation. This is going to be the future of this battle against extremist views.
Greg?
Yeah, I think you have to keep two conflicting ideas in your head at the same time here. One, ISIS is clearly not completely destroyed. Baghdadi can appear on a video. U.S. intelligence estimates are there at least 14,000 ISIS fighters out there somewhere, mostly scattered around the border between Iraq and Syria. They could regroup. They could cause another problem. On the other hand, there's no caliphate, and there's no immediate prospect that there will be one. And so you're in this gray zone where the attacks that we saw in Sri Lanka could occur again. Yeah, maybe ISIS is directing them. Maybe they're just inspiring them. There's lots of soft targets around the world. And that's the kind of zone we're going to be in, where they haven't disappeared. It's unlikely that they'll disappear. But they're not. There needs to be vigilance to make sure they don't regroup.
The Iraqi government, I think I saw, said that they could narrow down al-Baghdadi's location to one of four or five locations within Iraq. I heard that, and I thought, do they even know he's in Iraq?
Think we know that. We have not gotten confirmation on that. Nothing close to that. And like I said earlier, that's going to be the job of the intelligence services, is trying to unpack every single detail they can from a video like that. At the same time, think about the risk that Baghdadi is taking at this point in time for whatever the strength of ISIS is, for whatever their future will be. That man believed it was worth it to come forward at this point in time to deliver that message and put himself in risk that way.
Which indicates indicates that he believes he has a strong incentive to do so, to, if not put ISIS back on the map, at least show the world, hey, we're still here, even if we don't have territory in eastern Iraq, western Iraq and eastern Syria. Let's move on to France, where widespread protests have continued all across that country. Wednesday, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators took to the streets for annual May Day protests. This year, the protests turned violent, though, unlike in years past, with much of the blame falling on yellow vest protesters. French authorities responded to this violence with tear gas in the crowds. Nearly 400 protesters were arrested. Nina Maria, who are the different players in these demonstrations? They've been going on for quite a while. What explains the strength of these protests and the continuing nature of them week after week?
Well, I think one of the difficulties for Macron is that every time we think the movement is waning, they come roaring back into force. The thing that has slightly changed the equation in France is that public opinion is now stacking up against the yellow vests. I think the last poll I saw was that 60% of the French public actually would wish that they would rather go away. I think Macron has been taken by surprise at the level of venom and anger in the yellow vest movement. One of the difficulties with the May Day protests is that, of course, as you say, the May Day protests are a tradition, a great tradition of the French. And of course, this year they turned violent. I think the numbers put protesters out in the streets of Paris at 30,000. There was some 7,000 police out on the streets, and as you say, it turned nasty and violent. The main gripe for the yellow vests is that Macron has ignored them. They're demanding social equality. He will not tackle the wealth tax, which is one of their biggest complaints, but he has tackled the fringes of pension cuts, and that's an issue that they hold very dear to their hearts. But their main preoccupation is that they feel abandoned by the urban elite. And Macron, although he seemed like a new style politician and brought a kind of a youth and energy to the French landscape, it is interesting to me, you know, I do wonder whether he will one day go the way of Dominique de Villepin and be allowed to somehow bleed to death. So,
Greg Myrie, it can be easy to lose when you see social media posts of some action by yellow vest protesters. Oh, look, he spray painted a car. This one blew up a storefront. Something makes social media rounds and goes viral. It can be easy to lose a connection not only to what the protesters actually want, which Nina Maria put a word on so ably, but whether any of these protests have even made a sign to leading toward any kind of political accommodation, or whether it's just a standoff, no change whatsoever.
Right. Well, they have won some concessions. I mean, a week or so ago, he did announce some income tax cuts, some worker bonuses, extra support for single parents. So they have won a few concessions, certainly not the extent of concessions they wanted, and they're still out there, and it's a mixed group. So even if one group may feel satisfied, others will not. Can they sustain this if a majority of the French are opposed to their demands? But I think Nina Maria really put it well, that it does, and on the larger picture, it seems to be a major obstacle for Macron instituting the large-scale types of changes that he came into office to do.
Well, if we go just across the channel into the UK, we will find Julian Assange, who found himself in front of a British court on Thursday for an initial hearing on possible extradition to the United States. He told a judge that he would not surrender himself to be prosecuted by American authorities. Now, just to remind people, Julian Assange was a key player in one of the greatest leaks of classified information in American national security history in 2010. Many of the documents revealed confidential information about United States wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The day before his hearing this past week, he was sentenced to 50 weeks in jail for jumping bail. Next hearing is set for the end of the month. How much trouble is Julian Assange really in? There's a couple of things going on with
there
him.
There are a couple of things going on. Of course, the big thing to watch is how the extradition process is going to play out. It's going to take a very long time from all the experts I've talked to. At the heart of his arrest, though, is a real debate over what it means for First Amendment rights. And this is the kind of thing that's worth a conversation around the arrest, whatever happens with Julian Assange's case, because a lot of folks had a feeling it sent a chilling message to to journalists that it matters not only that you may receive information that may have been illicitly gained, but that maybe you were a part of getting that information. Of course, Julian Assange was not arrested and is not wanted here for the leaking of the information. It was about how he went about getting it, that he worked with then Bradley Manning, later Chelsea Manning, to break into a Defense Department computer to get the information. Well, some journalists say, what happens if you work with someone on an encrypted chat to get information? What happens if you advise someone on how to fax a document to you? There's a lot of gray area around this one issue that's worth exploring, and that has sent some troubling messages.
And Julian Assange is also not charged with any role in the latest round of leaks from Hillary Clinton's campaign that led to so much of what we've read in the Mueller report. Greg Myrie, Amna raises some interesting problems around Julian Assange. A lot of other journalists look at his case and say, if you get information and publish information, even if it's not popular, that's journalism. When you choose a side and publish information one way because you're trying to steer politics in a certain direction, that's something different. And then we get into a meta conversation about Julian Assange's role and whether he belongs in handcuffs or somewhere else.
Right. I mean, the sort of distinction I would make would be, okay, who's the legal conversation about who's doing journalism, who is a journalist and who isn't, and what is legal and what isn't. That's one conversation to have. And then I think we can also have a general non-legal conversation about what journalism is. And, you know, Julian Assange with the WikiLeaks material was taking material and dumping it out. I mean, journalism is what you do with that material. It's how you process it, and rather than just dumping it out there. So in a sense, that my organization certainly wouldn't consider that journalism. But then again, I separate that from the legal question: does he have the right to do it, and does he have the right to operate that way? Again, just reinforcing the point Amna made up: he's not being charged with leaking the information. It was attempting to break into, or helping or assisting the break-in of U.S. military documents.
I want to take a moment and talk about former Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, who passed away on Sunday at the age of 87. Lugar was a Republican. He was elected to the Senate in 1976 and twice served as the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And we got this note from Laura, who says, "We just lost one of our greatest statesmen with the death of Senator Lugar, someone who spoke with civility and humility, who reached across the aisle to get things done, whose reputation was that his word was bond, which led to both parties seeking him to help resolve issues." Nina Maria, talk about the legacy a little bit. Richard Lugar is from a different time in politics that, even though it wasn't that long ago, seems very far in the past.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I think we live in a world where there aren't many old-style politicians left. They just don't make them like him anymore. And I think we saw that in the outpouring of grief and emotion in his passing, the same with John McCain. By stark contrast, I think the fear is that we live in a dangerous world, which is increasingly governed by strongmen and new-style politicians. His death has been dubbed the end of bipartisan foreign policy. I'd go a step further and say that it also marks the end, or contributing factor to the end, of multilateralism and the desire for coalition building and creating a global community. He's known, of course, for his very important work on non-proliferation. I'm sure Greg can address that. But I did want to just touch on his role in South Africa and the anti-apartheid movement as we approach the South African elections. He was instrumental, really, in galvanizing international opinion and also changing American policy on the apartheid government, and he was instrumental in overriding President Reagan's veto on targeted sanctions. And that was an incredibly important moment because it led to American companies disinvesting, universities disinvesting, and it was a pivotal moment in which America finally landed on the right side of history.
There was an op-ed in the Washington Post on Wednesday by former Democratic Senator Sam Nunn, who wrote about Richard Lugar and said, quote, "He worked in good faith with both Republicans and Democrats, earning respect and trust for his grasp of detail and ability to find common ground." Here's Richard Lugar himself speaking at Georgetown University in 2013.
"Very often bipartisanship is mistakenly used as a synonym for moderation or centrism. But one does not have to be a centrist to act in a bipartisan fashion. Almost every day at the United States Capitol, deals are cut as a part of the machinery of legislating. Most of these deals are tactical and are frequently motivated by political calculation. I would define true bipartisanship as the suspension of the pursuit of political advantage in the interest of doing something necessary for our country.
Senator Richard Lugar in 2013. Greg Myrie, Sam Nunn, foreign relations senator of the Democratic Party, wrote about his colleague Richard Lugar in the Washington Post. They are famous, those two names, for the Nunn-Lugar Accord, Nunn-Lugar program, the Nunn-Lugar law. What is it?
So after the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, there were all these nuclear weapons, nuclear materials that was not well taken care of. And there was a thought that it could be stolen, that it could be spread easily. So they gave money, and it was controversial in some quarters, to Russia to take better care of its nuclear material. It was, and I lived in Moscow in the 1990s, saw some of this. It was putting fences around nuclear facilities that were unfenced. It was putting supermarket barcodes on the material so it could be tracked. Really basic, important things. And perhaps one of the most extraordinary, it wasn't a direct, but indirect, part of this broader effort, those Soviet nuclear weapons, about 10,000 of them, the highly enriched uranium in them was blended down, sent to the United States to be used in nuclear plants. And until about 10 years ago, 10% of all the electricity in the United States was coming from nuclear power plants powered by former Soviet nuclear weapons.
Amna, former Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee was the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, but not for long. He found himself unable to be both bipartisan and a senator of the Republican Party. He's gone. And I just contrast that with the career of Richard Lugar. And I ask, is there any form of bipartisan foreign policy going on now in the United States relating to Syria or North Korea or Yemen or anywhere else? Do we see any spirit of the kind of cooperation that Lugar brought to this job?
I do think, because sometimes the headlines tend to focus on the many ways in which our government is divided right now, which do capture a lot of the national attention and many of our political headlines, a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes of the everyday government workings does get lost in the conversation. There are always some kind of ongoing bipartisan efforts, even on some controversial things. I've been hearing a lot about some members of Congress who are working on humanitarian issues on the border. You talk about immigration as an incredibly divisive and emotional topic right now. There are people who are working to try to bridge the gap between the two sides. None of that will take hold, though, until the highest powers find a way, and the leadership all the way up to the White House find a way to bridge some of the divides.
Yeah, that kind of cooperation is a reality on Capitol Hill, but they don't implement any of this. They rely on the White House and the administration to do it. And that question remains a big one, whether any of that bipartisan cooperation or action would ever be implemented if it did rise up on Capitol Hill. NPR says House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler has now sent Attorney General Bill Barr a letter presenting a counteroffer to obtain access to the unredacted portions of the Mueller report or face contempt of Congress. The letter says, in part, the committee is prepared to make every realistic effort to reach an accommodation with the Justice Department if the department persists in its baseless refusal to comply with a validly issued subpoena. The committee will move to contempt proceedings and will seek further legal recourse. We request a response by 9 a.m. on Monday, May 6th, 2019. So writes the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee to the Attorney General. I have often wondered if this Attorney General would care if Congress held him in contempt. Eric Holder was held in contempt by Republicans in the House, and it didn't seem to affect his life too much. Joining us here in the studio, Sheila Smith, Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Sheila, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Talk a little bit about Japan, where one era has ended and another has begun this week with the ascension to the throne of a new emperor there. The Japanese monarchy is believed to be the oldest hereditary monarchy in the world. I hope you tell us how old it is and tell us how unusual it is for Emperor Akihito to abdicate as he did this week.
Thank you. It is thousands of years old, and as far back as we can tell, it is the oldest monarchy in the world. Akihito is the second emperor in the post-war period, so after 1945, after Japan lost the war. And under the new Japanese constitution, his role was to be the symbol of the Japanese people. So he doesn't govern like his father did in the pre-war period. He actually tries to represent the country, but no direct political role. And so for Akihito, who's just stepped down, and his son, who's just stepped up, this is this personal interpretation of this role of symbolizing the Japanese nation that's been quite so fascinating for me to watch in the last couple of days. Akihito, as you pointed out, decided himself, many say 8 or 9 years ago even, that he wanted to step down in a transparent way, in a way that would be predictable for the Japanese people. And his father, of course, passed away. And it was a very uneasy time in Japan because people weren't quite sure what to do. So he wanted to avoid that. And there was a lot of resistance in
the
country.
It's known as the chrysanthemum throne in Japan. What will Akihito as emperor be most remembered for? Will it be this decision to abdicate, which is so very rare?
I think it's that, in the way he is very methodical and rational about this process. In other words, taking away the mysticism and the kind of murkiness about the imperial family. But he and his wife, Empress Michiko, I think are going to be remembered for their compassion, first and foremost. They were very outgoing, very much associating themselves with the vulnerable populations of Japan. And we saw that after the earthquake in 2011. They went to the victims' shelters. They got down on their knees. They sat and they listened time and time again, offering their thoughts and condolences and support. Second thing he's going to be remembered for, though, is his position on the war. He is seen as somebody, he and Empress Michiko were seen as somebody who wanted to reconcile with Japan's neighbors. They were the first to go to China in 1992. His father, of course, couldn't go because his father prosecuted the war. His son has a very similar bent, I think. They see themselves as wanting to remind the Japanese people of the importance of learning a correct understanding of Japan's 20th century history.
There was a time in Japan's history where this royal family, the emperor, was viewed, if not as a god, godlike. And you're describing a situation where not only politically has that changed because of, you know, the governmental role and the ceremonial role, which is much different, but it seems like Japanese society has changed in their view of the monarchy, and indeed in the view of the monarchy of itself and its role.
That's true. I think the interesting thing about the abdication is the Emperor Akihito sort of treated it as if it was a job. You know, I have done my job. It is time for me to step down and let somebody else come in. His son uses the same language. You know, my job is to represent the Japanese nation. So it's a very different, I think, social understanding between the Japanese people today and the imperial family about what their relationship is. And people on the street, when the media was asking them questions, how do you feel about the abdication? How do you feel about this? They all said, oh, he's done a great job. He's 80-something years old. It's time for him and Empress Michiko to enjoy their retirement.
Japan is changing politically, though. Shinzo Abe, the prime minister, wants to change the constitution, has talked about altering Japan's post-war commitment to non-militarization, I'm not saying they're getting aggressive, but the constitutional prohibitions on any aggressive military stance whatsoever. I don't know if the royals themselves have a role in this debate, but the political society is changing as well, and changing on the practical level where the politicians who have the power want to change Japan's status in the world.
That's right. So we're 3 generations after the war now. So you've got a very different mindset, I think, on the part of contemporary leaders in Japan, and especially for those coming up. I just finished a book on this question of the Japanese military and the Japanese debate over the use of military power. It's a very effective moment to be looking at the way in which the Japanese think about their military in the region, especially we watch the North Koreans move in the direction of acquiring nuclear weapons.
And China as well.
China is expanding it. So Japan has some serious thinking to do in terms of its defense policy and its relationship with us. But what you don't see in the constitutional debate is Japan wanting to get rid of Article 9, which is the no war clause that was imported by General MacArthur way back when. Nobody is arguing that Article 9 should be abolished. And the Japanese people certainly see Article 9 as a promise that they won't support a country that is going to use its military power offensively.
An emperor abdicates the throne in Japan as the prime minister contemplates a change in Japan's posture, especially when it comes to its neighbors, North Korea and places like China. And everyone around this table, you may not be experts in the Japanese monarchy the way Sheila is, but you are experts on China. So I want to take a moment and talk, Greg Myrie, with you about a very interesting story that you reported on NPR this week. It's a story of spying. Tell us about the ex-CIA officer who pleaded guilty a couple of days ago to spying for China. What does he admit to doing?
Right. So this was a case in U.S. District Court in Alexandria, Virginia on Wednesday, and I was there for the case. Jerry Chunxing Lee was a former CIA officer, spent 13 years with the agency, part of it in China. After he resigned in 2007, he settled in Hong Kong, where he'd been born and he was a naturalized American, became a private businessman. 2010, he meets with Chinese intelligence officials, and they start giving him money. The FBI secretly goes into his hotel room when he visits the U.S. in 2012 and 2013. They find a couple books, notebooks with handwritten notes with the actual names of CIA covert officers, of CIA asset sources inside China. They don't arrest him at that point. They did arrest him when he came back to the U.S. again last year. He has pleaded guilty to conspiring to give information to the Chinese, acknowledged that in his plea. He'll be sentenced in August. It looks like a plea agreement talks about a sort of 21-year or so sentence, but the judge is free to give him anything up to life as he so chooses. What's interesting beyond that case itself, this is the third time in less than a year where a former U.S. intelligence official has either pleaded guilty or been convicted of spying for China. And so we've been hearing more and more about the Chinese spying efforts in the U.S., and we're sort of catching up with what's been happening for the past decade or so. These cases date back 5 or 10 years. The Chinese, in this case, we see, were very interested in this sort of traditional spying, getting government and military secrets. But it's very widespread, very much in terms of getting U.S. high tech, of getting information, cutting-edge research at universities. So sort of massive spying operation that no other country has really exercised against the United States, and the country is still coming to terms with the breadth of it and how to combat it.
Now, Sheila Smith, we've heard about this direct spying that Greg is talking about. We've heard many, many stories about other forms, not only universities, agricultural research centers, lots of people on Capitol Hill concerned over the entire existence of Huawei, a Japanese communications company that Americans suspect is simply a front for the Japanese government. Anything they install in your office building might have listening devices. I'm reducing it. It's fairly reductive. Or in the U.S. government, what's your sense of how widespread Japanese espionage is in our society? Can we put a handle on it?
It's Chinese espionage.
What did I say?
Japanese.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Chinese.
I just want to make sure your listeners understand talking about China.
My mind was still with the chrysanthemum throne, and I didn't mean to cause an international incident. We are talking about Chinese espionage. Yes, exactly. I apologize for the error. Sheila, go ahead.
So the technological piece is, of course, the Chinese are moving out towards the forefront of technological innovation in the 5G sector. And so it becomes very hard to regulate that because, of course, we've always been in the forefront. We've been in the front line, and we haven't worried about ourselves so much. But the China now has assets and has capabilities, and other countries are interested in those capabilities. So the conversation with the UK and China on Huawei, for example, makes us very worried because all of a sudden we're looking at the next generation of communications and information technologies that could be dominated by Chinese systems, or at least integrated or penetrated by Chinese systems in a way that we can't manage. But I think back to the sort of traditional spy stories of the kind of human assets. The Chinese have obviously been very, very active in recruiting our former intelligence officers and such. They've been very, very active for a long time on cyber, and they both in the traditional sort of state-to-state spying, but also in the commercial espionage.
Nina Maria Potts, you were just in China, right?
That's right.
Are these stories, I don't assume, are reported in the same way that they're reported here, but are they reported at all? What's the espionage culture in the news media like there?
Well, it's a good question. There is a substantial effort underway by the Chinese government to talk about stories focused on hostile activities by foreigners. And I think back to Greg's point, I mean, one of the striking things about that particular case was the decimation of the CIA from 2010 to 2012, which came as a bit of a body blow to the CIA and has been compared to the situation, I think, in Russia in the 1980s. So that was very striking. The other thing to say about having just recently been in Beijing is that there is a hostile environment, I would say, that there are fears among journalists and foreign delegations and diplomats about Chinese aggression. There have been detentions and arrests and death sentences. This is against a backdrop of worsening relations between the US and China, but also Canada and China, where we've seen a second death sentence this week against an American national, I mean, a Canadian national. And I think one of the most alarming and perhaps depressing takeaways is that even among sinologists, people that have studied China, who love China, who have really invested years in hoping for engagement and dialogue, are beginning to walk away and worry about the future of U.S.-China relations.
Amna.
Yeah, obviously at the heart of that tension between the U.S. and China is the scope of that intelligence gathering. Christopher Wray, the FBI director, said recently that it is enormous in its scale, that they use every possible asset that they have, researchers, private companies, state-owned entities as well. The Huawei question is going to be one to watch, because that is something, look, three of the Five Eyes networks, right, the U.S., New Zealand, and Australia have banned that company's technology being used in their firms, specifically because of those concerns. I interviewed Ajit Pai recently of the FCC. As the U.S. is investing now billions of dollars in growing and expanding that necessary 5G fifth generation network here in the U.S., we have to remember we have no domestic manufacturing capability to support that here in the U.S. We're entirely dependent on foreign firms. Nokia and Ericsson are not nearly where Huawei is. They are the leader in this space. That's going to be a problem for the U.S. moving forward.
Sheila Smith, final thoughts on how the United States manages this huge problem of Chinese espionage. It's widespread throughout industries and politics and intelligence agencies and culture when we have trade concerns, when we have military concerns, when we frankly want to do business with them.
Well, I think it's going to restrict a lot of the ways that we've interacted with Chinese and Chinese citizens. So whether it's educational exchanges, business investment in China and vice versa, Chinese investment here, it's going to start to really constrict the activities that I think our government is going to feel comfortable with.
Well, I want to thank you all for being around the table with me. I apologize for pinning espionage on Japan when I meant China. Shouldn't have done that, but hopefully the embassy has hung up their phones and they know that I just made a mistake. Before we go, though, I want to make sure that we get to this one last story.
A small band of men on a perilous search for the man-beast of Tibet, the abominable snowman of the Himalayas. You've heard of him, haven't you?
Now, people have been searching for the abominable snowman for centuries. Some call it the Yeti. Well, now, a group of mountaineers from the Indian Army says they found evidence of the beast. On Monday, the Indian Army announced from an official Twitter account that its expedition team in Nepal had stumbled upon, quote, mysterious footprints of the mythical beast Yeti. The tweet included three photos of large footprints in the snow, as well as a photo of the mountaineering group, a selfie. Of course, the Nepalese army dismissed these claims right away, saying the footprints probably belonged to a wild bear, which hangs out in that area. Now, Nepal and India, though, will have to hash out their Yeti sightings, but no Yeti on Earth has ever done more for the galaxy than the interstellar Bigfoot, the Wookiee, Chewbacca. The co-pilot of the Millennium Falcon was played by actor Peter Mayhew in five Star Wars films. Peter Mayhew passed away at his home in Texas on Tuesday. He was 74. Everybody in this galaxy and in galaxies far, far away will miss Peter Mayhew. I want to thank all of you for joining me on the international edition of the Friday News Roundup. Sheila Smith, Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage at Feature Story News. Nina Maria, great to see you. Greg Myrie, thanks for being here, National Security Correspondent for NPR. And of course, Amna Nawaz, National Correspondent and Substitute Anchor on the great PBS NewsHour. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
1A senior team are Lindsay Foster Thomas, Danielle Knight, Denise Couture. This episode was edited by Miranda Fillmore. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It is distributed by NPR. Joshua will be back with you on Monday. Until we meet again, have a great weekend. Thank you for spending this hour with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A.